Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It was embarrassing. I thought that was embarrassing.
And the dogs are tied to people who are on skis.
It's graffiti, I guess, but with knit fabric.
It's easy to understand it in your head. It's a different thing to try to bring it to your dinner table and explain it to your family and go, this is something I'm really keen on.
This week on Culture Q, Bhutan, Pride Fest, and the Black Keys.
From the studios of KUOM Radio K, this is Culture Q, the arts show that rocks. Tickets are free, and there's no wait, so take a seat and hold on to your radio.
Hello and welcome to Culture Q. I'm your host, Sarah Bowden. We have a great show today, so stick around. Seven plastic resins, hydroponic tomatoes, organic Cheetos. Brady Nias takes us into the compost heap that is sustainability.
Roughly 30 to 40% of food co-op's inventories across the Twin Cities are said to come from local sources.
Last year, over 35% of our food was sourced locally, so the other 65% obviously wasn't.
We're in Minnesota, so you know we have limitations to how much local we can do.
That is, a limit to how many fruits and vegetables can be grown outdoors, thanks to our climate. While buying from co-ops with an emphasis on locally grown and raised food seems to be the eco-friendly way to eat, to what extent are we being brainwashed or greenwashed? In the world of the co-ops, there is a huge emphasis on energy efficiency. For example, there's this woman, Susan Stewart, who's a sustainability coordinator for the Wedge Co-op. She has, for the last 3 years, calculated energy usage per customer and per square foot of retail space. All while meeting with her, I couldn't help but notice this report sitting on the table, full of facts and figures that aren't being shared with the public. Stewart says she believes in transparency.
It helps us to be more forthcoming in what we're explaining, even though there may be some things that we might be a little embarrassed about. We will report that.
But does not yet feel comfortable releasing these data without more polish. Meantime, at least two nearby co-ops, the Eastside Foods Co-op and the Seward Co-op, already published similar information to their websites. But being undeniably green, it seems, is fraught with problems. One way to save energy is composting. And while all co-ops say they compost, there is disagreement on what's worth recycling.
What we do is the plastics recycling is we have...
That's Amy Fields. She's the general manager of the Eastside Foods Co-op and knows more than most about recycling. Here's what you need to know. There are seven recyclable plastic resins, and only the Eastside Foods Co-op recycles all of them. Over at the Wedge, Stewart says these programs don't really solve our environmental problems.
There are no regulations, there are no incentives in place for manufacturers to do that. They just use plastics that are best for them and cheapest for them to produce for their products. I mean, there are so many resins that by the time you collect and clean out, and they have to be cleaned out, your plastic containers, and bundled up and shipped, and by the time you do that, it could be rejected.
The 3 through 7 sort, I will say, is sort of demoralizing because what it means is that there's no individual call for any of those specific resins.
As for cleaning supplies, co-ops often look to their own shelves for inspiration.
Cleaning supplies that we do use around the food will be like vinegar water at our front end.
But then Allison Meyer, head of communications at the Seward Co-op, told me about this other, weirder option.
Russian scientists use this technology to clean oil pipelines to get that.
How does it work? Just add water, some Morton salt to the machine, and presto chango, you've got sanitizer and cleaner.
And it's even drinkable. Not to say you want to, but it smells like bleach, but you can drink it without harm to your body.
Lastly, most install a few solar panels on their roofs just to take the edge off their consumption habits. Mostly, it's for looks. To be fair, Meyer says this provides power to about 4% of the store's energy needs.
But maybe a more exciting way to say it is like 8 households in the neighborhood.
One last question. Paper or plastic? 3 points if you answered EcoTote. For Culture Q, I'm Brady Nias.
As far as refugee groups go, the Twin Cities' newest settlers, the Bhutanese, are doing well. However, one issue that the community is beginning to grapple with is how to take care of its elders. After 2 decades of being sequestered in Nepali refugee camps, Bhutanese of all ages are finally finding permanent homes in the U.S. For many who settled in the Twin Cities, the Lauderdale Apartments, which are right off Highway 280, are a place to call home. This is where I meet Bhutanese community leader Parmanana Katiwara. He's very concerned with how his community will take care of its elders in the future.
We could do better than what we are doing at this moment with the seniors, rather. They deserve a better farewell, if I put it straight away. They have given so much of their life, hoping that their future generation is going to do well.
Between a new language and confusing culture, many elderly Bhutanese choose to stay in their homes all day surrounded by family. And for right now, that's okay. One of the few pros of a bad economy, where lots of people are unemployed, is that grandma and grandpa always have someone to take care of them. And in a culture of extended kinship, even people like Dilka Adhikari, who never had children of her own, aren't lonely.
She feels that she cannot communicate with the other people. She cannot go and meet friends, but these kids are around here and she's happy to. And her brother is living right across other block.
In Adhikari's apartment, she sits cross-legged on a rug near a sunny window to warm her back.
Dilka Adhikari.
Her nephew's wife and children surround her, though she calls them daughter and granddaughters, as is the Bhutanese custom. The scene in Adhikari's living room is not so different than what her life would have been like in Bhutan. The matron looks serene, though older than her 77 years suggests. Because of the lives they've lived, her generation tends to age quickly.
Even though by United States standard, 50 is not old, they're still working, but back there, due to the type of life they've lived and the pressure and the difficulties they face, even after 50, we start considering people a little older, and after 55, they are almost old. We consider them senior citizens back there.
The Bhutanese who settled the Twin Cities are of a Nepali-speaking Hindu group called the Lochampas. The Lochampas resided in southern Bhutan for several generations until the 1980s, when the government deployed an army. This army arrested, tortured, raped, and killed thousands of Lochampas. Now, in their final years, finally safe from the violence and with a permanent home, many elderly are having a hard time adjusting.
It's the psychological isolation that's more difficult.
Dukha.
Adhikari.
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 Yeah, that's right.
Eventually, Kariwara would like to establish a sort of senior center run by other Bhutanese where they eat the food and speak the language and do the things that Adhikari and others have grown up with. Again, right now, there really isn't a need for this center, but there will be as people start to find work.
The kids, the people who will be looking after them have to go and work, otherwise the money is not going to come to run the house. And at the same time, their kids would not be making so much of money that they can put an assistant at home or somebody, a person who can take care of them. It's going to be difficult.
Furthermore, a place where Bhutanese come together might ease some of the loneliness the elderly experience.
Would it make you happy to have a place to go to every day so you can be as loud as you want?
Where the center is to be built and who will pay for the center and staff it, Kariwara doesn't know how it's going to work out.
I would be really happy. I would feel that I've gone back to my village.
But he feels it's the right thing to do. For Culture Q, I'm Sarah Bowden. Last weekend was Pride Fest. Culture Q was there, and we asked, what is the best and worst thing about being part of the LGBTQ community?
The best thing is the diversity within GLBT culture. I mean, there are 1,000 different kinds of groups here in the park today, and that great diversity, I think, really speaks to the strength of our community. It can be very cliquish. There are small groups that tend to go on power trips and not be interested or not like other groups within the community. So there is tension within the community and kind of squabbling and infighting. That's the worst part.
Best thing about GLBT culture is being able to find your flock, because it's so important. The worst thing about GLBT culture is that there's still discrimination. It hasn't gone anywhere.
I have seen a wide array of some really remarkable ensembles today. I've seen some very, very lovely fairies, lots of sequins. I'd say that is a really great thing about the culture, is the apparel.
The best thing about being someone that's GLBT in Minneapolis for Pride, I'd probably say, is the community. This is a fantastic time to see not only people that are living in the community that are also GLBT, but you see families, you see heterosexual couples that are here, you see single friends of people that are GLBT, and it's very nice to have that community and people that are supportive of you. You know, I think the only thing that's unfortunate is that we still don't have the same kind of equal rights as other people, like the ability to get married. I'm in love with someone, and I know that at some point, you know, it may progress to that point where I do want to get married, and that's not going to be an option here in Minnesota. So hopefully we'll see that change soon.
Have you ever been to a show at First Ave and then got really hungry halfway through but didn't want to leave and miss the music? Well, that's no longer a problem. The venue has a new bar and restaurant. Eric Dolsky chows down with this review.
So we're here at the First Avenue's new restaurant, the Depot, or the Depot. Depot or Depot? Depot.
It was a rhetorical question, of course. I, and soon, I should think, everyone else knows that it is both Depot and Depot, according to Merriam-Webster's online dictionary.
Depot. Depot.
But the pronunciation of a nearly obsolete French word is not relevant, as much as I've harped upon it for the past 21 seconds. Let's get back to the grand opening of First Avenue's Depot Tavern, where I sat with Radio K staff and alumni for a late dinner recently. And ask yourself, as I have asked myself, is there anything more obtrusive than talking with someone about what they're eating as they're eating it?
I'm Alex Goderud, the marketing director for Radio K, and I had a New Orleans beef po' boy with debris gravy. Actually, I don't think there was any debris gravy on it, but it was pretty awesome.
I'm Ellie Bjorklund, and I intern here at First Avenue, and I had the lentil veggie burger, and it had curry in it, and it was amazing.
I myself had a Monte Cristo on marble rye. It was pretty dece, as the kids say. However, as my past self will tell you,
I was kind of leaning toward the Diamond Dog, which is a hot dog wrapped in bacon and deep fried on a pretzel bun, but I figured I wanted my arteries intact.
But that's more than enough about food. First Avenue's Depot Tavern isn't about food, it's about atmosphere. Myself being underage and an admitted teetotaler, I don't often frequent taverns, so I asked my dining companions how the Depot compared to similar places of its kind.
It feels kind of like a fusion between like a bar and a restaurant. If it was a bar, it would be a lot louder, but people are more, you know, enjoying their meals, and I think that it's got more of like a relaxed, you know, kind of restaurant vibe.
The fact that these are combined has made it very like calm, and like the garage door to the street is open, and there's a nice breeze coming in, and it's very like urbane. I like it. I think on show nights that this restaurant will become very famous for its people-watching capacity. Lucky diners will get to spy on their favorite acts, and maybe it'll bring up the business of the restaurant if, like, Prince is playing in the main room. Will he eat at the Depot? Probably not. Like, tonight, I'm convinced that several members of the Black Keys are here somewhere.
I feel that based on televised emulations of pubs in sitcoms and primetime drama, the First Avenue's Depot is definitely a tavern or a very compact bar-restaurant. Barstaurant.
Barstaurant.
Alex Gatterud made one more point about the Depot's menu and how it relates to the Minneapolis oeuvre.
When, like, a venue opens a restaurant, usually it's just, like, burgers and, like, chicken tenders. But this is really, like, baked mac and four cheese, like, green pork chili, the Diamond Dog. Like, these are all things that you wouldn't really expect from a venue restaurant. You know, as far as the, like, revitalization of downtown goes, along with Target Field, like, this is a big step toward making Minneapolis really fun to hang out in again. So, yes.
I think Alex was implying something, but I'm not sure what. Regardless, when I go back to the Depot for a First Avenue concert, or just for kicks, I won't be thinking about how the Depot fits into this so-called revitalization of downtown. I'll be thinking about whether or not to get the Diamond Dog.
Which is a hot dog wrapped in bacon and deep-fried on a pretzel bun.
For Radio K's Culture Q, I'm Eric Dolsky. Yes.
Welcome back to Culture Q. I'm Sarah Bowden, and right now I'm joined in studio with reporter Katie Dyson. Hey, Katie.
Hey, Sarah. How's it going?
I'm good. So you've been watching a lot of soccer lately, right?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the World Cup.
But sometimes really silly calls by refs are made, correct?
Especially this World Cup. It's been quite the epidemic here.
Yes, that's a great way to put it. And so that got us to thinking about other silly sort of mandates that are inflicted on people, which got us thinking, of course, of silly laws.
Naturally. And Minnesota is actually at the top of the list as far as having some really goofy laws.
That's right, because you did some research on this.
I did. You can find all of these laws and many more and many different states on the internet.
Oh, the internet. Love
yes.
the internet. So you have compiled a list of the seven silliest laws that you found. And so what's number one?
Number one is that citizens may not enter Wisconsin with a chicken on their head.
When would someone ever need to enter any state with a chicken on their head is my question.
Well, I think it might go down to kind of the economic and trade situation and the rivalry between Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And especially the livestock rivalry.
Yeah.
Because Wisconsin is the dairy state. And I think maybe decades ago, we made a push to become the chicken state. And there was espionage going on.
I'm with you, except on the head. When I'm smuggling illegal substances or materials, because that's something I do in my off time when I'm not doing radio.
Well, naturally.
I don't put things on my head when I'm trying to be a sleuth, if you will.
It's certainly not the ideal place, but of course hats were kind of a big thing.
That's right.
Back then.
That's right.
So maybe there was a special brand of hat that was a chicken smuggling hat.
Hmm.
Maybe the 10-gallon Texan hat came up to that Minnesota.
Logistically might be possible.
I think so. It would have to be kind of a skinny chicken, but
yeah.
Yeah, and you'd have to convince the chicken to perch on your head too, which I think would be difficult.
Number two.
Number two. You are not allowed to park your elephant on Main Street in Virginia, Minnesota.
Because apparently elephants are rampant in Virginia, Minnesota.
We actually had a herd of snow elephants distantly related to the woolly mammoth.
The snow elephant from Canada.
Yeah, they came down from Canada, and I guess they've been a problem in Virginia, Minnesota.
Apparently. I do feel a lot safer knowing that I won't encounter any parked elephants on Main Street in Virginia, Minnesota. That does give me some peace of mind.
Well, if you are heading off of Main Street, I would suggest taking a friend or some type of elephant repellent because, you know, they can only cover Main Street. The side streets and the outlying areas outside of town might still be a little dangerous.
That is excellent advice. Thank you.
Yes. Good luck.
Number three.
Number three. Red cars may not drive down Lake Street right here in Minneapolis.
Do you think this is like a libido thing? I love Lake Street. It is one big party from end to end. But do you think when this law was made, Lake Street was just a little too nuts? Or what was going on that they needed to stop all red vehicles?
Well, it's certainly a color prejudice. But actually, studies have shown that drivers and owners of red cars receive the most speeding tickets on average. Definitely slowing things down on Lake Street might have been on our lawmakers' minds here in Minneapolis.
I could see that. Number four also has to do with colors, actually, right?
Yes, this time it's not red, but blue. The color blue has been banned since 1913. It is illegal to wear or paint anything blue, and anyone entering the state in a blue car must pay a fee or be sent to prison.
I ride the bus all the time, and Metro Transit's lettering is red and blue. Does that make me accomplished? Should I go to jail now?
The honorable thing to do would certainly be turning yourself in. Of course, all of the families living in blue houses, anyone wearing blue shirts ever, anyone wearing blue jeans would have to turn themselves in.
Wow, it really disgusts me, the level of crime in this state.
I know. Pretty much everyone in the state is complicit.
I saw Governor Pawlenty wear a pair of blue jeans once. He should go to jail, obviously.
Naturally. And think of the prison overcrowding.
It's just silly. Number five.
Number five. No man is allowed to approach his wife with the smell of garlic, onions, or sardines on his breath.
I like that. I like that a lot. Very, a lot of times with these goofy laws, they're kind of derogatory towards the woman.
Definitely.
It gives the lady a little bit of power.
It does, certainly. And I think it goes a long way to preserving the marital union.
I totally agree.
I think we should add other foods to the list. You have a feta cheese prejudice.
Yeah, feta cheese. I like eating feta cheese, but I don't like kissing people who have just eaten feta cheese unless I've also just eaten feta cheese. Really, the whole Greek salad should be on the list, I think.
Definitely. I think the true takeaway from this law is always brush your teeth before attempting to make love with anyone.
I concur.
Yeah.
Number six.
It is against the law for any woman to laugh at the size of a man's penis.
How would you prove this one?
That is a good question. I think we might be dealing with a case of penis blushing, perhaps.
Oh, perhaps. It's not like you can use forensic science to prove laughter. It's not like you can test a phallus for laughter. There isn't, unless I haven't been watching Bones closely.
Obviously, the latest CSI. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. This would definitely be a very interesting step in the field of forensic analysis, for sure.
Yes. And an excellent use of medical science's time.
I think so. I think we should push our tax dollars towards researching, testing various body parts for laughter.
Yes, I agree. And number seven, the silliest law that you found on the books.
Well, in Brainerd, every man must grow a beard.
So do you think a bunch of Hasidic Jews took over Brainerd City Council one year? Like, how did this even happen? How is this law?
Well, the Hasidic Jew population in Brainerd might be a definite possibility.
Yes, because as we know, it's a large community.
Yes, exactly. I think maybe it's just a bunch of men deciding that Novembeard, the charity thing in November where every guy grows a beard, or at least it's an excuse to grow facial hair, much to the chagrin of their girlfriends or wives or partners.
Yeah,
exactly.
But they just wanted to last all year round.
Yeah, they couldn't part with their beards, and so they just moved north to a climate and a friendly...
Beard-friendly locale?
Exactly, a beard-friendly city council, perhaps.
Of Hasidic Jews.
Yes, exactly. I wonder what the women in Brainerd think.
You know, some girls go for the beard. It's a thing. And the flannel. It's like a beard and a flannel. And there's a lot of crossover. It used to be like ladies who like lumberjacks, but now it's ladies who like lumberjacks and guys who ride fixed gears, you know?
Oh, yeah. Very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
It takes all types. Well, Katie, this has been informative. So thanks for coming in.
Well, no problem. I enjoy looking up all these goofy laws.
Working off the Ohio Duo's connection to older R&B sounds and adding in the hip-hop they made with their Black Rock side project, the Black Keys have a new album. Zach McCormick brings the noise.
Mm-hmm.
a testament to the band's creative drive that the Black Keys have even made it all the way to album number 6. They survived the boom and bust of the early millennium garage rock revival and the subsequent backlash against all things retro. Punching their way out of the long shadow cast by that other monochromatically named Rust Belt guitar and drums duo, the Black Keys have developed into something altogether different in recent years, courting hip-hop styles while remaining true to their roadhouse roots. On Brothers, the Black Keys seem to be determined to nail this odd fusion down, trading the sometimes aloof minimalism of the 2008 Danger Mouse-produced album Attack and Release for something altogether more raw, foreboding, and delightfully scuzzy. The intensity of the band's blues punk stomp still rings through on this album, but this time around, Pat Carney's drums boom bap like 808s, and Dan Auerbach reins in his searing guitar lines into immaculately funky grooves. Perhaps still inspired by 2009's Black Rock side project, where the duo collaborated with several rappers, including Mos Def and RZA, Brothers contains some of that dirty Wu-Tang Clan grit on songs like Howlin' For You. To the stick, swing and miss, and a catcher's mid strike, too. Baby, I'm howling for you. Danger Mouse also shows up again to produce the stellar Tighten Up, where Auerbach moans over a dubbed-out guitar, and Carney's busy, syncopated drums feature a chorus that rapidly approaches post-punk. Take my badge, but my heart remains loving you, baby child. Tighten up on your rings. Recorded in the legendary Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Alabama, Brothers really had no choice but to sound incredibly soulful, especially in its latter half. Unknown Brother is a masterful songwriting effort for the duo, a guitar-heavy version of the 60s and 70s soul that the studio made famous. Auerbach does his best Big Otis impression over the mournful words of a family's loss. Subtle notes of strings and marimba give a lush depth to the album's closer, These Days, which sounds like Al Green stayed up all night listening to the last waltz. Tree cover that old fort. I miss it, Lord. I miss it, Lord. While it may lack the fist-to-the-jugular immediacy of the band's earlier work, Brothers showcases the Black Keys at their best, synthesizing diverse styles while always feeling cohesive. Elements of the past, present, and future sit comfortably together in a record that feels so warm it's practically sweltering. Perhaps more than just sound waves made it onto wax from the album's birth in one of the landmarks of American music. For Culture Q, this is Zach McCormick.
Watch what you say. The devil is listening. He's got ears there.
Well, that's our show. This week, you heard stories from Brady Nias, Katie Dyson, Eric Dolsky, Josh Ellis, Zach McCormick, and me, Sarah Bowden. Our producers are Eric Dolsky, Brady Nias, Zach McCormick, and Christetta Borini. Until next time, this has been Culture Q.
Wasted time.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.